man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hello, 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 everyone, and welcome to another episode of Who Shot Ya? I am your host, Ifiwadi Way, but in the booth with me, the digital booth, further than 6 feet, are my friends, and I'm going to introduce them to you right now. First up, we have Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
Oh, you know, Ify, this falls in the category of things that if you'd asked me 6 months ago what my what's good was going to be in May, this would not have been on the list, but face masks from JCRT. JCRT is this company in New York. You have probably, back when I used to leave the house and wear shirts with buttons on them, you saw me wearing their distinctive plaid shirts, which I'm a big fan of. Anyway, so their factory had to close down originally because it was deemed non-essential. But so that they could keep the workers busy and getting paid, they have basically converted to just making face masks, still featuring their distinctive plaids. So people can go to their website and order a set of them that are, you know, they're stylish and they do the trick. You know, they are as masky as you need them to be. And then also they have a thing worked out where for every mask you buy, they donate to New York City first responders and to Dominican first responders, because that's where the factory is located. So they're not making any money off of this thing. It's just a way to sort of keep the machines going, keep the workers employed, and to provide a thing that everybody needs right now, which is face masks.
At first, I thought you meant like face masks, like facials, because I got a mud mask and I was going to relate to you on that. Yeah, but you meant the ones that are keeping us alive.
Exactly.
Yeah, totally. Big. Once again, trying her hardest to not interrupt during Alonzo's portion.
If this had been about the other kind of face mask, she would have hopped right in.
Yeah, I know. Well, I know. I saw her face. She was so ready to say something, but held back. So we got to introduce her to get that mask take. It's Drea Clark. What's good?
You guys are growing so much as a human. My ability to not interrupt for 30 seconds is like transcended. My immediate thought, well, A, I like Alonzo's and I will check them out. And B, Ify, I'm definitely going to need you to send me a photo of the kind of mask you're using so we can discuss all of its properties. If you also need to introduce a sheet mask into your regime, you know. What's good with me is actually the kind of thing I think Alonzo would normally do because it's a regional food-based thing.
Ooh.
But I was reminded this week through one of our Who Shot Your friends and listeners that I've connected with on Twitter, Jess Kubis, mentioned Top the Tater, which is a Minnesota specific, it's like a dip, a sour cream based chive and oniony and like seasoned dip. It's made for like baked potatoes, but you can use it for chips, you can use it for everything. It's so good. It's only in Minnesota. I haven't remembered it for years. And then of course I was like, okay, do they ship it? Can they order it? And so it does look like there is national shipping. I'm not sure if it's, you know, not happening right now. But you guys, I've been craving Top the Tater since she said that. And like, it's one of those, like, you can't make it yourself. There's no like, oh, I have a home. No, you don't. Just buy the Top the Tater.
I need
it's
this
also
in my life.
Called Top the Tater. Like, I mean, that's perfect. It shouldn't be called anything else. So yeah.
Our last guest, writer, podcast, all around treat. We've been hyping up the how much of a treat they are via text. Now you'll get to experience it in your ears. Elizabeth Lame, what's good?
Oh, hi guys. Okay. Mine is also a regional treat, but and by regional I mean for the entire goddamn world. And also it will span many lifetimes. This is going to last. Each individual packet of this is Entenmann's coffee cake.
Ooh.
Have not. If he's dancing. This is something my husband did as a panic buy early into our quarantine. You know, when you're just doing supermarket sweep into your grocery cart. And it has been, they're individually little wrapped servings of the coffee cakes. They are so good, you guys.
That sounds so good.
And they don't have the usual, like, I'm not mad at Intamin's, but there's usually like a waxy situation. I'm telling you, you could put these out on a plate for like a garden club tea party and no one would know the wiser. It was
for the finest of attendees.
Yes, the fanciest people you could imagine.
Pinkies out.
And we booze a little, but we're not huge drinkers. But truly at the end of the day, my husband and I are like, we're hitting up that Entenmann's box. Like, we save it all day and it's our one true joy.
Whatever gets you through, no judgments.
Yes.
Is it one of those that it had like 120 individual coffee cakes in it or something?
No. Well, each box sadly only has six, but we have now 12 boxes of it. We've stocked up.
See you in hell, toilet paper.
Yeah, we're going for that Intamin's. Oh, yeah, that's the good stuff.
Iffy, what's good with you?
What's good with me is going to be a pro tip. There is a website, if you do not know, called nowinstock.net, to where you can get text and email alerts for some of these hard to get items. For example, they have toilet paper and wipes, hand sanitizers, household cleaners, respirators and masks, hand soaps, alcohol, thermometers, laundry, paper towels, tissues, webcams, oximeters, grocery and food, hydrogen peroxide. Now, obviously, I use this to purchase a VR headset. Which has been so hard to find, but you know, I did get it. It worked. They alerted me. I went and bought it. They alerted me at 108. I purchased it. It was sold out by 118. That's my pro tip. Nowinstock.net, and they also have a Discord if you're a gamer like me, where it alerts you on Discord as well.
I'm gonna go program in Entenmann's coffee cakes.
Someone's wiped out the entire Los Angeles County. Yeah,
some jerk snapped them up.
Yep. On today's show, we're gonna be talking about the film How to Build a Girl. Of course, we'll get a call from the Who Shot line, and as always, end it with some staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment. This is Your Movie Life. The season finale. With movie production halted and movie release dates getting pushed back, our news sources for Itadic have run dry. So instead, we will take a voyage through our lives and discuss the films that have shaped who we are today. And since we're currently in our early 30s, all of us, this is going to be our final week where we discuss the movies that were most important to us in our early 30s. Elizabeth, would you please begin?
Yeah, mine's a real toss-up. I have two. One is Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which I think was released actually a few years before I was in my early 30s, to be fair, but to me. but I think it was one that I like rewatched a lot, and it was kind of my touchstone feel-good comedy go-to. The other one is It's Complicated, because I'm a huge Nancy Meyers fan. Ooh. Not gonna lie, no shame. Right. And the kitchen in that one was just out of this world. She made chocolate croissant.
Yeah,
I was all in.
That's the movie where Meryl Streep is spending the entire movie redoing her kitchen because it's just not big enough, and the opening kitchen is already like staggering. So you're like, what is the kitchen gonna be?
And then she takes him to her away kitchen, which is a whole huge, amazing guy's dream of dreams.
Away kitchen. Oh my God, I want to live a life where I just can use the phrase, I have an away kitchen. I also love that I do appreciate in Nancy Meyers, there is no shame in the full just like capitalistic embrace and consumer love. They're like, oh no, this is the stuff we enjoy. And also, she will be wearing impeccably flowing linens.
All right, Drea, what do you have for us? What do you have?
Mine is also a film that came out a good decade before my early 30s. But I was trying to think, you know, we started doing this in childhood and whatever. And there was something about the earlier phases where it was easier to think of movies that I watched a lot. And by my 30s, I was trying to take in so many new movies all the time that it was much less about revisiting films over and over. So I was thinking, well, what was a comfort film for me? And there is definitely one, and that movie is Amelie, and it is still a comfort movie for me. And I think it's something that speaks at all sorts of times, but there was something about being early 30s, and once you hit your 30s, you're like, oh yeah, no, I'm an official adult now. But also, Amelie is an adult fairy tale, so it's mm-hmm. still escapist. It's still a little. It's very whimsical. It has a lot of heart. It's beautiful. It had the sort of like the kind of love story I particularly enjoy, which is people who are truly finding things out about each other that are not just like, you're the prettiest person in the room and so am I. So yeah, Amelie. I still revisit that, but I definitely, like, I went as Amelie for Halloween one year and brought a gnome around everywhere with me and had the wig. I am not a waifish French woman, but I don't care. I loved being Amelie.
That's such a good one.
Alonzo, what movie are you jamming
at? Well, I had further to look back, obviously. Here's the thing, like, you know, I have been sort of a movie obsessive my entire life, but at the age of 28 is when I started. That's when I became a full-time film festival programmer for the first time. I was running the USA Film Festival in Dallas, and that was when I really sort of discovered what's involved with watching a whole fuck ton of movies on like a regular basis, you know, like week in, week out, just like piles of screeners you have to go through. Drea knows this very well. And
yeah,
so
I'm nodding heavily.
Exactly. So once you enter that phase, it's sort of harder for one movie to kind of stand out in a way that they did when you were younger and you didn't see as many. But I think at that point is when you sort of really start equating the experience of seeing the film itself with something else in your life or with someone else in your life. So mine is also going to be a little bit before my early 30s, but it's one of the first movies that I remember really bonding with Dave over after we met and became a couple, just because we were living in Dallas. This was a movie that was caused a lot of controversy, and a lot of people were talking about it and reporting on it. And then when we actually went to go see it, watching the number of walkouts while it was happening became sort of a bonding experience for us. We wound up seeing it twice, and both times just sort of like counted the number of people heading for the aisles and running for the exits. And that movie would be David Cronenberg's Crash. The NC-17 adaptation of the J.G. Ballard novel, which, as Dave always likes to say, they sold it like it was a combination of like it was going to be Death Race 2000 with fucking, and it wound up being something else entirely.
That was such a satisfying end to that lead up, I have to say. Yes. I was like, what the fuck?
Alonso always sticks the landing. Yeah.
So that's a movie that I just, when I think about that period of my life, I just think about, oh, it was so great seeing Crash, which is a movie we loved so much, and watching everyone else like leave in a huff, you know, because it was not the movie that they were expecting it to be or that they wanted to see or whatever. So I'm going to go with that, with the good Crash.
I would say that makes me think of a movie in my life that was marketed one way, and then the reality was so crazy different. And this was right after my mom had died from cancer. I was 19. My boyfriend took me to see Stepmother, which was marketed as this like...
Oh, Stepmom? The Julia Roberts?
Stepmom, yes. It was marketed as this like feel-good, like mother-daughter rom-com. And it was... I was one of the walkouts, but I feel like I had good reason.
Well, yeah. Yeah, they Marley and me'd you with that one.
Oh, yes! Oh my gosh.
Oh man. Yeah, no, you know, even though Alonzo clarified, I'm still going to, in my head canon, will be the 2004 Crash.
No! That, no!
It's so funny, like, thinking of it being remembered that way, because at, you know, 2004, I was probably, yeah, I was like a junior, a sophomore, junior in high school, and me and my like siblings and our like friends at school thought the movie was so deep. We were like, oh, this is cinema, you know, it's just seeing the things that people can just be going through in one night. I have yet to rewatch it, and I almost think I should.
Don't. No good can come of it. Bring us home, yeah. Miffy.
Yes. Now it's time for I to bring us home. My early 30s, which is now, considering I am 32. It is a movie that I know I would not have ever came across my radar. Probably wouldn't have branched out to see it if it wasn't for this show right here. And then that's it's also a movie that has made me go like, yeah, I should go out my comfort zone, because there's like a lot of good. And that movie is last year's Judy. Yeah, because I kept thinking about how much I liked that movie and how much I just would have just missed it. It would have been something people would have talked about. She would have got the statue for it, and I would have been like, oh, I didn't even know that movie came out. I called the statue right after seeing it. I still got to pat myself on the back for that. But yeah, I think, it's just kind of
by statue, you mean an Academy Award?
Yes, yes. You know, that's what,
you know,
that's how me, you know, us in the biz, we call it the statue.
Sure.
You know, when I'm on the phone with Leo Dio, I'm like, man, how's that statue doing? You know, or if I DM Timothy Chalamet, I'm like, man, you should have got that statue that one year. You know, that's what we call it.
Sure.
One I would have guessed, but this is exciting.
Like, irony that I'm staring at you all in Zoom right now because you're in these squares, and yet I'm realizing I should never try and put Iffy in a box because he will not stay in that box. Like, Judy, amazing.
He contains multitudes.
He really does.
Oh, yeah. I love it. And it really kind of shifted and now have made me like try and consider seeing things I wouldn't see, and then go, Alonso Andrea is going to do that for me anyway. But that's our movie lives. You know, we'll have some other fun bit to continue. What it will be, I can't tell you yet. Not because we figured it out, but because we haven't. But we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Hi, I'm Jackie Cation.
Hi, I'm Lori Kilmartin.
And we have a podcast called The Jackie and Lori Show. Who are you, Lori Kilmartin?
Oh my God, so much pressure. I'm a stand-up. I've been doing stand-up since 1987. I'm a writer for Conan. I've written a couple books, have a couple CDs out, have a special out. Who are you, Jackie?
Well, I too am a stand-up comic since 1984, and I do the road like a maniac and don't have a cool writing job, but I have 4 albums out, working on a new album. We talk about stand-up. We talk about all the different parts of stand-up comedy. So that's the Jackie and Lori Show, and you should subscribe on Maximum Fun if you want to hear that.
And I would encourage you not to.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Iffy Whiteyway. In the virtual booth with me are
Drea Clark,
Elizabeth Lame,
Alonzo Duralde.
And today we're talking about how to build a girl. Elizabeth, since you're our guest, would you mind providing us with a synopsis?
Yes. Well, this is a coming of age starring Beanie Feldstein as an awkward, but I'd say confident, joy-filled, enthusiastic young girl in England in a time that's not now. And she...
The 1990s.
That's right. She finds a new version of herself, I would say, via stepping into the adult world that she has kind of idolized, and through the movie realizes it's not all it's cracked up to be. That's my synopsis.
It was good.
Yeah, that was solid. Yeah.
It was really artful. Great. Yeah.
Terse. I like it.
I mean,
the one thing I'd add to the synopsis, because not everyone knows this, this movie is based on an autobiography by Caitlin Moran called How to Build a Girl. She's has a trilogy of them, actually. She's a pretty well-known comedic writer, especially in Britain. But this mirrors her life in that when she was also 16, she won a writing competition and became a rock critic. And this, you know, I'm sure the comparisons to this will be not for us, but like the world at large will be like, oh, it's the girl version of Almost Famous, or attempting to have that arc to it. But yeah, similarly, it's based on Caitlin Moran's actual life. So she's just someone of interest, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But what I was going to say is, you know, kind of thinking of someone like Alonzo, who knew he wanted to be involved in film stuff from a young age, to like being like, you know, having his parents drive him to art house theaters and stuff. Well, did you relate to the main character at all?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, she begins the film not really knowing anything about pop music, you know. She gets the gig by reviewing the Annie movie soundtrack. You know, so clearly it's more that she's a really interesting writer and has a voice than it is that she is obsessed with the medium that she is covering, you know. I found it hard not to think about Almost Famous, only in terms of the fact that I felt like what was unfolding in Almost Famous, even though it is the sort of rose-colored glasses version of Cameron Crowe's, you know, young life and prodigy years at Rolling Stone, there was a sense of reality going on there that I didn't always feel in this movie. But I want to hear from the women first, because I think I just want to hear from them first.
I did not have any problems with realism, because I very much recognized a lot of what Beanie's character was doing. And also really appreciated the idea of a girl that age who feels like an outsider, not because she feels invisible, but because she's too much. Not to say I relate a lot, but I did. And I certainly was much more of a like toe the liner. But I really loved seeing this girl who blended the kind of confidence that I had with also the recognition that there's deep lying insecurities, or I don't know. I found it very believable in her approach and in her desires to like make a mark on things, and how she threw herself very headfirst into everything that she was doing. Headfirst, heart first. She was just throwing herself. A lot of throwing. Yeah. Elizabeth, what about you? Did you find her believable, or?
I did. I mean, I have a real mixed feeling about this. I think it's a film I will think about a lot and will probably pop into my mind. And especially regarding seeing this like unapologetic and also enthusiastic. I loved how like positive and hopeful she was. And then, I mean, kind of continued to be. But the issues I had with it were that it wasn't as like, for whatever reason, it wasn't as entertaining to me. I wasn't like pulled in. And I also was kind of comparing it to Almost Famous, which also I watched 20 years ago, but like
but it
that
stays with
I
you.
Wanted to watch again. It stays with you, and I wanted to watch it again and again and again. And something about this, I was like I actually stopped halfway through it and went and did some other stuff, and then I came back. You know, it was like kind of not pulling me through. But then upon reflection, I'm like, oh my gosh, it was so rad how like XYZ happened. I found it very exciting to see a young woman like exploring her sexuality unapologetically. I really enjoyed a lot of it. But for, I don't know, it just wasn't like, it didn't pull me in the way I wanted it to. And I wonder if part of that is just my age now. And I'm so much further away from that time. I don't know.
I mean, like, maybe part of it for me is that I have worked in journalism. And so there were a lot of things there where I was like, you know what? If you hire a 16-year-old and then they turn in a first draft that you don't like, you don't fire them. You send them back and say, no, make these changes or write it this way. So, like, there were a lot of just little moments like that that I didn't buy. And then, and also, I think this is part of a tradition of both fiction and nonfiction films about kind of young, outspoken women who are maybe in a small town or in a repressive environment who just like cannot help but kind of burst forth into the world, you know, whether it's My Brilliant Career or, you know, Wish You Were Here. There's a lot of films that follow that track. We are presented with this character at the beginning as being so shy and nervous and nerdy and like afraid of the world, and then she gets this, she manages to talk herself or her way into getting this one gig, and then we are like one shopping montage away from her being this just like super explosive figure. And I'm like, I think maybe there were a couple of more steps in there that we're just zipping right past. And again, I think a lot of this comes down to a thing where we've discussed before on this show when we've looked at biopics or whatever. It's like, just because something happened in a certain way in real life, you have to still present it cinematically in a way that makes narrative sense. And that didn't always happen with me. But I do like her brashness and her sort of voraciousness for living and for, you know, getting out in the world. It is one of the rare teen movies that acknowledges that teenagers can be fucking assholes. You know, like she does some really terrible stuff that she then later has to kind of atone for. And like the movie is right for making her atone for them. It's not like, you know, that they're punishing her for being, you know, a strong woman. Like, no, she's genuinely terrible at times. And I think kind of then dials it back.
I will say it bothered me that at the end, I didn't think she atoned for enough, and maybe that's my own shit, but like
she does get off a little easy. Yeah,
like she ripped her dad apart. She had ignored her brother, who's going through arguably something much bigger than her, and the film never spoke to either of those things. And then I have a real issue, sorry, with the fact that she, whether or not she was attempting suicide at the end, it appeared that way. And basically everyone came in one scene and then they cracked a joke about the scars on her wrist. And it was like, and everything's nice. And I understand everything about who I am. Like if that was real, that's not pulling you out of the dark night of the soul. Like that's it.
Glib.
I mean,
right. I do think it did have elements because it's an adaptation that was also written by, the screenplay was written by Caitlin Moran as well. Oh my God. So I don't know where to look. So it's an adaptation that's not just by the person who wrote the book, but the book was their autobiography. So they're like locked in a number of ways or tied to things. And so I'm sure the book covers 100 times more than what this does. And because of that, like, I agree that there are things to me, like the quick montage into becoming Dolly Wilde, who's her writing alter ego, is very quick. But I also know as a producer, if I was giving story notes and it was a much longer development, I'd be like, no, just get to her being that person. Like, you're gonna, like, either we're spending a whole movie of, because to me it was, and I agree, I see it both ways. Like, I see what you mean of like, she just threw that on. But I also think as much as she was a bit nervous or awkward, she also was someone who had such a rich interior life. Like, she has this whole wall of literary and celebrity figure pictures.
Which I loved that.
Which
I
is
really
a great device and like really well cast. They're clearly connected.
That didn't work for me, I have to say.
Oh, like, I loved it.
I thought it was a funny idea, but I found the execution kind of, and they kept coming back to it and I was just like, oh.
Yeah, no, I almost agree with the Dolly Wilde thing. As someone who is closer to their youth,
he's 32. He's not a child.
Yeah, but I do remember, you know, when you're like kind of a dorky person or you're not as popular in school, you have a perception of like what a cool person is, what this person is, and like how you might see yourself as being a cool person. So it totally made sense, and I liked the montage, and then her ending up looking kind of like a magician and not like even being cool. But that's like who in her head, she's like, this is how a cool person who doesn't care about what they look looks like. So that worked for me. And like all of that stuff, I actually really did like the like conversations with the people on the wall. It was subtle enough, good old Sylvia Plath suicide joke, stuffed in there too.
I want to circle back real quick to something that Drea said. This is not a first feature, actually. The director.
Oh no, I meant that it had that feel. Sorry, you're absolutely right. I didn't make that sound right.
She's made a lot of British TV, and actually did a film that I saw at Sundance back in 1996 called Stella Does Tricks. It's really good and super depressing. So at least this is, not super depressing.
More upbeat.
Yeah. So yeah, that all that kind of worked with me. I like, until, it gets kind of shitty. I like that her and her brother had this like close relationship, because I feel like you never really get to see that much. Every time there's a teenager and their brother and sister close in age, they hate each other. And me and my sister have always been like dead close. Like we'll like piss each other off, but it'll never, like, we've never had anything to where we'll like not talk to each other. We were ever really mad. If anything, we just were always, and it's because we're two years apart that we're just like inseparable. So I always like when you see that in movies, because that's something I do relate to, of him being like, okay, you can crack my piggy bank to do your little like
to get your magician's outfit.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I thought Beanie, I will say, did a fantastic job in this. And I think it is funny because she's playing a 16-year-old. I'm not exactly sure when this was filmed, but I think she's like 24, maybe?
She is 26, and I'll tell you why I know that.
Okay.
The mom in this film is 33. So that was a real, like, when I first saw that, I was like, oh, no, 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 no.
Yeah, I think.
But Beanie became a believable 16-year-old, I will say.
Yes. I think the mom was a teenager when she had her in real life. She wasn't 7, but I think she does a very nice accent work in this. Although, of course, we are open to anyone who lives in the Wolverhampton region to correct us on that.
Please chime in. She is good, and I do like the fact that they figure out a way for her to be like a sexy large girl that is, and it's never commented upon in the film. Nobody ever comes after her about her size. She presents herself to the world with such confidence that everybody just takes it as like, yes, this is you.
Well, there it's is commented like, on twice.
It is, yeah. I was like, I always noticed that, because there is a small thing, and I do love how her physicality is used, because the idea that she's not a girl who's just like a cookie cutter, waif. Like, oh, the pretty teen, whatever. But she's comfortable, and that it doesn't play into the sort of section where she's like unleashing her sexuality, but it does come out in like in the sort of when we get to the end and we need to start to introduce some conflicts, and like there's the guys that she works with and one of the guys that she's been involved with, when she overhears them talking about her. So it's something that, and to me, that makes it more believable. Those are absolutely people that would comment on her body. But it wasn't an ongoing thing of like Bridget Jones. Like, she's not like, oh, I'd make it better in this world if I was skinny. Like, that's never her thing. She's like, oh, I'll make it because I've dyed my hair this crazy ass red and I'm dressing like a magician. So, yeah.
I don't want any UK people complaining about, Americans coming over to take your gigs, because American television is wall-to-wall United Kingdom, Australians, and New Zealanders with impeccable American accents.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is, I I had to, we had to put a stop, you know, they always joke on us, but I had to put a stop on that when we got my man, who I love, Idris Elba, this is the tone every black British guy right here, quite Southern, slight New York, this is where I'm at if I'm a British black guy in an American movie. I'm like,
Daniel Kaluuya is better than that.
Yeah. I like quite Southern, a little New York.
Let's give our final review of How to Build a Girl. And since we're all still teening, hopefully, would you stream it over Google Hangouts, stream it by yourself, or skip it? Let's start with our guests. Elizabeth, what do you think?
You know what? I would recommend watching it at home. You know, when you, like, you're like, what should we do?
I like, you really set the scene of that. There's two people. They're at home. What should we do?
There's literally nothing else.
Yeah. I would be a stream it over Google Hangouts with a small caveat. This is a film that fits into a conversation we had recently about programming for certain people versus broad recommendations. And I think this is a film that would, more than a lot of films we talk about, I would stream this with a very specific group of my friends, but I have a whole lot of people that I'd be like, stream it sometime. And like, you know, it's fine if you're like cooking dinner while you're doing it or whatever. Because this is something that I think very much will speak to a different group of people versus a more universal, yes, everyone will love this film for sure, always, which we've had films that I felt that way about. So that's mine. Try and write that into a box, Casey.
I got very close to skip at times on this one, but I'm ultimately going to go with stream it by yourself. Because it does have a good energy to it. I do think Beanie Feldstein is putting in a mostly interesting performance. I have a lot of issues with the writing and just a lot of the setups of this person's life and how it's being portrayed. But I guess there's enough there that's worth a look.
I think I'm going to plus one what Dre is saying. I think this would be, if we were allowed to go to theaters, would be one of those fun, like, teen flicks that people would go and see, and that, you know, older people would be like, okay, it's all right. But, like, kids would be like, oh, yeah, this is great. You know, like 2004's Crash.
How dare you?
So for that, I'm going to say stream it over TikTok for the kids. This one's for the kids, and let it be written. And so it is written. So it is, shall be. You know the quote. We'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
All right, Adam, Maximum Fun wants us to record like a promo to tell people that they should listen to The Greatest Generation. You want to do that?
No, I am tired of all the extra work. I just wanted to talk about Star Trek with my friend.
I think it would be good to like try and get some new listeners by appealing to the audiences of other shows. Like this will only take a minute or two. It could be good for us.
We sit down for an hour every week and talk about a Star Trek episode and make a bunch of idiotic fart jokes about it. It's embarrassing. If it got out that we made this show, I think it would make us unemployable.
Adam, I have bad news for you. We have tens of thousands of listeners at MaximumFun.org.
Oh my god. I think I'm gonna throw up.
The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. Every Monday on MaximumFun.org.
I'm really gonna be sick.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the virtual booth with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Elizabeth Lame,
Drea Clark.
Now it's time to answer a call from the Who Shot line. So Casey, play that call.
Hey y'all, this is Al from Southern Virginia. I just watched Under the Shadow last night. So after that, and with all this quarantining, I was wondering what are some of y'all's favorite movies that take place mostly or entirely in one location? Thanks, love you, bye.
Ooh, good question, Al.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Whether or not those are the movies you want to be watching right now is a whole other story, I guess.
Yeah. I love you too, Al. She said she loved us.
Yeah, oh, well, yeah.
She deserves to have it reciprocated.
It's mutual.
I love you too.
We assure you.
Yeah. Just right back at you.
I have to jump in immediately because when I think of movies in one location, Clue always comes to mind first and foremost, largely because I think so often when people play with this as a concept, they go like thriller or suspense or dark, like, and Clue is so lively and so ridiculous, and it's the one set and they shoot, you know, all over it, but you feel like you know that whole house by the end of it. You know every room, you know each thing, and they do inventive, fun things throughout.
It's as though you grew up with a layout of it on a board.
What? What do you mean? Like you've been staring at the blueprint your whole life? That's hilarious. And I didn't even think of it. But yeah, I've always loved Clue anyway, but in terms of, like, because it's often in indie films, it's a gimmick of, like, Paranormal Activity. If I shoot, which he shot in his house at the time, and so if I shoot it here, I can save on costs, I can do whatever. There's obviously, and most of the ones on my list are bigger budget, but I appreciate Clue for its one location and its upbeat energy.
Well, mine is an indie, but it definitely is one that I think of immediately for this kind of thing. And that would be the Tom Hardy film Locke, L-O-C-K-E, Ooh. Where this does not happen very often in my life as a film critic. But sometimes I walk into a movie with no idea of what it is, what it's about. Sometimes not even who's in it. Like, that's the thing I always love, especially by going to film festivals in other countries, is just you get to walk in as tabula rasa. I went into Locke not knowing anything. And so Tom Hardy gets in the car, he gets on the phone, he's talking, we're in the car, he's talking on the phone, he's in the car, he's talking on the phone. And about 20 minutes in, I thought, what if he never gets out of the car? And he doesn't. He spends the entire movie in the car having phone conversations, and it is riveting.
Yeah, my knee-jerk pick was obviously going to be Fences. No, I'm kidding. Green Room is definitely the top of my list.
Oh, yeah.
It was so solid. It takes place within the green room for most of it, but just that one bar, and then a little bit outside of it. I've been looking at some lists, and some of these are wild, but I do want to talk about some of the classics after we hear Elizabeth's pick.
So mine, I mean, might be cheating a little bit but it is mostly in the one location, and it's one of my top favorite films of all time, and that's Christmas Vacation.
Mm. Oh. Ooh.
It's at that house, we're in the attic, we're in the kitchen, where he's fantasizing about the pool. One of my all time favorite scenes is with him and the cousin in their living room, and he and Randy Quaid are just like starting to catch up, and he's talking about his daughter who like was in the circus and then leaves. Randy Quaid does this little tiny thing. There's this like little Christmas decorative thing with these, it's like a windmill going around, and he just gives it a flick and the whole thing falls. It truly kills me, and it's not addressed.
He just does it. He messes with the prop. Yeah. It's I just so remember good. Randy Quaid wearing a black dickie under a white V-neck sweater, and it yes. made my life. Yeah, that one might be a cheat, but I'll accept it because now I'm happy to have thought of Christmas Vacation.
I would add to that also Buñuel's The Exterminating Angel, which is about a group of people who go to a dinner party and can't leave the room. And like 12 Angry Men, I think it really kind of plays into the sort of claustrophobia of the situation and how they're not there by choice necessarily. And it's just like, you know, just the mounting tensions and lunacy of being in these sort of close quarters. You know, to keep it on the Christmas tip, Die Hard, of course.
Yes.
You know, and then I'll nerd out a bit and say My Dinner with Andre.
Okay, I honestly was like, I'm gonna flip my table if he doesn't say My Dinner with Andre soon, because the world will no longer make sense to me.
Does Snowpiercer technically take place?
Yes, absolutely, it does.
On that train.
Yes.
On that
train.
And yeah. Sorry, the Bong Hive is gonna bong if we're gonna bong out. You know,
and the movie that I always called Snowpiercer set on one end, which is High Rise.
Yes. Yes.
But yeah, thank you to everyone who's called in. The number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. And now it is time for the staff picks. Look, I'll switch it up and I'll kick it off because I finally completed in my Blu-ray collection. I had to, of course, I've explained to Elizabeth, to the crew, that I've been getting the classics. This trilogy of classic, I had to buy them separately because it was hard to get them all together. It is the John Wick trilogy as it stands. Parabellum came in, and I feel like, you know, Parabellum, John Wick just kind of is on the run, and he's running through different ends of the world, and I think that's a great movie to sit back and remember a time when we could leave our house and travel. Like, that's all I was thinking. I went for a walk, and I was like, the first thing I'm gonna do is, when I get some free time and this is over, I have to travel, because there's
so
many places.
Get on a plane, fly to Morocco, and punch a dog.
Punch a dog.
Can't
get
wait.
Get my finger cut off. Get my ring finger cut off.
Find Halle Berry.
Find Halle Berry. Have her spit in my drink. You know, all of that. You know, I will forego all of the traveling just to go to that part. but you know, whatever it takes.
Well, I have a very different staff pick, energy wise. But it's a film that's currently on Netflix, and we've definitely discussed before, The Florida Project by Sean Baker.
Nice.
I think this is a good time, if you haven't seen it. Speaking of classics, I do think this is something that in a few more years would be part of a more modern group of classics.
And speaking of one location.
Yeah. It's at this apartment complex in Florida. Go figure. This poverty-stricken... Actually, everyone in it is struggling with money. Willem Dafoe plays the building manager. And then there's a cast of mostly unknowns and primarily this young actress, Brooklyn something.
Prince, I think.
Yeah, Brooklyn Prince, who does a really lovely job. Anyway, it's so beautiful. He makes really immersive filmmaking that is empathetic, so it never has that kind of manipulative feel that some films that are emotional have a take, like that you leave feeling like, yeah, that put me through the ringer and I feel a little abused with it. And this is more just, oh, I feel very human.
I was just going to say, he's one of our great humanist filmmakers right now.
Yeah.
He can make movies about... embattled communities of which he is not a member, and it never feels like he's like a misery tourist.
Yeah.
Cool. Mine is a film from the last couple of years that I really enjoyed that didn't get a giant release, and I think that people are still sort of discovering it, and it is currently streaming on Stars, and it's called Space Station 76. It's the directorial debut for Jack Plotnick, who's a familiar face as a character actor, and it is a really daring film in that visually it is basically using the tropes of 1970s futurism. It looks like what a 1970s sci-fi movie thought the future was going to look like, you know, like Silent Running or Space 1999, like that kind of thing. So it has this sort of like immediate goofy kitsch appeal, and everybody's smoking and drinking Harvey Wallbangers or whatever. But in that context, it is telling a really kind of melancholy story that would have fit in like a sort of suburban anxiety movie like The Swimmer or Ordinary People. It's about unhappy marriages and you know, closeted gay men and just sort of like all these people have problems and are unhappy, and you know, and that is as 70s as the like weirdly retro like tech and fashion choices and sort of general, you know, art direction of the film. So it's an odd combo, and I think a lot of audiences who went in expecting it to be Spaceballs or something were kind of maybe put off by it. But if you let yourself go with where this movie wants to take you, I think it juggles all that stuff really well. Has this really terrific cast, including Liv Tyler and Matt Bomer and Patrick Wilson and Marissa Coughlin and Jerry O'Connell. And it's quite possible that you missed it during its theatrical run. So Space Station 76 on Stars, give it a shot.
Guys, I landed on one.
Yay.
Oh my God.
Ooh, yeah.
This might be, I share this with so much reservation, but.
this is a safe space, Elizabeth.
I feel like I'm about to say Garden State. Not really, but like that's the level that we're getting to here. this is a film that I want to rewatch because when I was in my early 20s, it was one of my favorites, and it was Secretary. And it did, I have a scar because of it, because when I started dating my husband, I told him it was my favorite film, and he then took that to mean I was like into some freaky shit, which I was. And he like threw me against the brick wall. Anyway, guys, I would be curious to watch it now.
That should come with a caveat, I think, if you're telling somebody you're dating that you're into that movie. Right? There should be a but attached.
I'm artistically into this movie.
You know, I am so... I'm dying. Just the supportiveness of like, oh, you like this? I got you. Let's go.
Yes. Yes.
He was yes anding you.
How yeah, relieved yeah, really we was. Both were when we recognized the misunderstanding. but I think it was good. Like, I need to go back and see if I still feel that way, because in some ways I'm like, maybe it was really simplifying, and also like as a post Me Too feminist, like what's going on there? I don't know, but I'm going to recommend others revisit it the way I'm going to, and don't hold.
I support Secretary. I support it, and I also think I do think it handles with care a lot of the potential red flags that could be that are part of any sort of open any sexual relationship that is about. Well, they're all about dynamics and power, but that are specifically about these things and the safeguards and the consent and respect that need to come with that. And I do think a lot of what Secretary was doing was weaving people who wanted this thing and teaching them the language of doing it supportively and smartly. So it's also fun and sexy. So there you go.
All right. Well, it's time for 5-star reviews. And if you don't know, if you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on air. Like this one from Jelly Rhubarb. I'm a film buff and I'm very engaged by this podcast. The hosts are knowledgeable and have a range of experiences and taste. The rapport is excellent and their enjoyment of the discussion is infectious. I listen on Sunday evenings as I'm cooking and I really look forward to it. Such a gem. Well, Jelly, I want to know what you're cooking. You got a steak in there?
They're cooking jelly and rhubarb.
I was
going to
say, they're making rhubarb jelly, which is delicious.
Yeah, lovely. Put that in a pot. Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for joining us. Anything that you would like to plug?
Thank you for having me. Let's see. You can find me on Instagram at Elizabeth Lame, L-A-I-M-E. And check out season 2 of I'm Sorry on Netflix, which I wrote on. Ooh. And season 3 will be coming whenever the apocalypse is over and we can shoot it. Check that out too someday.
Ooh. So now we've got some big old announcements. So get out your cows, your eye cows.
You're out of glances.
Yeah, out of glance. Yeah, get that. But here it is. Number one, on May 16th at 1 p.m. Pacific time, we'll be doing a live watch party of The Avengers with Jordan Morris, and we'll be streaming on my Twitch channel, which is www.twitch.tv/ifds. All you'll need is a Amazon Prime account. That's how you'll watch along. And don't worry, if you don't have an Amazon Prime account and you have the Blu-ray of The Avengers because you're team physical like me and Alonzo, then don't worry, we'll have the time code up on the screen so you can watch along while you watch it any which way. That means if you're watching on Disney Plus, if you're watching on, I think it might still be on Netflix, but you're able to watch it however you want, because we'll have the time code on the stream. Just match it up, you'll be at where we're at. So look, do it. But you will need a Twitch account if you want to talk and chat. So, and that's completely free, and you don't need anything for that except using an email or whatever. So let's make a party. Let's watch something. I'll whip up an official Who Shot You drink called Who Drank You.
Oh my god.
And we'll all be drinking it.
I can't wait.
The pepper
I'm really hoping the Avengers win.
Who knows? It could go anyway. And number two, starting with our May 22nd episode, the Who Shot Ya fam is going to be all about the family. We're going to be making our way through the entire Fast and Furious catalog. Woo-hoo! Each episode, we'll be discussing two films from the series. So May 22nd, we will discuss both The Fast and the Furious and Too Fast, Too Furious, Too Fast, Act a Fool. These I am so, I'm way more excited about this than I probably should be. And what's going to be funny is for Tokyo Drift, it's going to be the first time I watch it because I have actively and purposely avoided Tokyo Drift because back when it came out, I was really into drifting and I thought that it was an embarrassment to the art of drifting. I didn't like that Paul Walker and Vin wasn't in it. I thought it was a bastardization of the series and family, and I've avoided it for this long. As a, it has been a something I have chosen to forget.
Please, but, please tune in for the series because we will definitely make Iffy repeat the phrase, when that came out, I was super into drifting.
Iffy, I was willing to let the Casablanca thing go, but you haven't seen Tokyo Drift?
I have. As a reminder, you can if you'd like to buy a Jumbotron to promote something and have me convey as much passion as I have for my hate for Tokyo Drift, just go ahead and head over to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. Next week, we'll be discussing Driveways with comedian Mike Kaplan. Again, the number for the Who Shout line is WSY 803-1664, making your quarantine activity, your teen-tivity. Calling in to the Who Shot line. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/ Who Shot Your Podcast, or send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. Alonzo, Andrea, always a pleasure. Anything you want to send us off with? Anything, any like nuggets of knowledge?
No, man.
Take care of yourselves and each other.
Yeah. Live the drift, you guys. Live the drift.
Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.